Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Does President Trump know his history well enough as he urges his Twitter followers to study the late Joseph McCarthy? The president was clearly referencing Robert Mueller's work as special counsel, but the analogy may work in ways the president didn't expect. Elizabeth Cobbs is with us. She's a professor of history at Texas A&M and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. And she joins us today from San Diego. And Elizabeth, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Terry. Great to be here.
I think I'll also open the phone lines here. If you have questions about the legacy or the history of Senator Joseph McCarthy and how it applies or doesn't to today's political arena, I welcome the question. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Elizabeth, let's set McCarthy in the right historical context. He rose to prominence, what, during the Truman administration when we were a country on edge about the Cold War? What would you add to that? There's a lot more to say, I know.
Yeah, well, he was one of those folks who's in a crowd that's, in a way, milling around, already nervous about something, and then shouts, you know, fire. So this was a period in which people were worried about what was going to happen with the Soviet Union, and were concerned that there might be communist infiltration, and, you know, those were reasonable concerns. But then he just took off with it and whipped up further these flames of hysteria.
What would you say that he understood about the anxiety of the times that, you know, many, many, maybe other politicians and Americans hadn't really identified?
Well, you know, this is the crazy thing, Terry. I mean, our founders understood that demagoguery was a kind of disease of democracy, that democracies were always vulnerable to sort of popular passions. And it would be easy for somebody to exploit them at a time of general nervousness. So that was McCarthy. I mean, he was somebody who, you know, drove Americans in the direction of their worst fears, and then, of course, rode to office on it and to fame.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about democracy's vulnerabilities, because we had a show yesterday where we talked about whether we realize that democracies can be vulnerable, and if we do realize that, that it has to be, that democracy has to be practiced like a habit. Two guests on that. It was a really interesting conversation with a lot of input from our callers. What would you say about this idea to guard against a McCarthy rise?
Well, I think that, I saw that you had a show on that, although I didn't hear it. But, you know, I think it's our founders, again, I'm sorry to keep spouting that, but it's just, I'm so reminded of it, how, you know, they talked about that the worst, the folks who were most likely to exploit this weakness of democracy were ones who would pander to the populace first, you know, who would sort of, I'm a man of the people kind of stuff. In fact, Alexander Hamilton was one of the persons who said, you know, the worst tyrants always start out by pandering to the people and then end up becoming, you know, sort of masters of the situation. So I think that that's, you know, it's not, again, it's nothing to get freaked out about it, because that's part of the problem, right, is that we allow our fears to run away with us. And as Franklin Roosevelt had said, you know, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Biographers have called McCarthy a chronic opportunist. I think you've just verified that with what you've said, a galvanizer of mobs and a manipulator of public opinion. And I was reading something that Politico wrote about him, about McCarthy, a while back, saying that half of Americans polled by Gallup in the early 1950s had a favorable opinion of him. So what was appealing about McCarthy as a figure and as the things that he was, you know, asking America to regard, to look at about ourselves?
Well, you know, he had kind of an aw shucks kind of demeanor. So, you know, he was from Wisconsin. He was a Catholic. He was kind of a regular Joe, if you will. And he would just had his, you know, an ability to kind of put his finger right on the button. I mean, he had this way. He perfected what people later called, historians called, the big lie, which is you tell a lie so big that people go, oh, well, wow, there must be some truth to that. And in a way, he appealed to this deep need people have often in times of uncertainty to believe that, you know, that there is a conspiracy out there, that that the reason why they're struggling is not because, you know, stuff happens, but because, you know, there's a plot. And you know, bad things do happen. But the, you know, of course, the most mature and responsible way to deal with adversity is, you know, to be calm about it and to find a way forward. But, you know, he was one of these people who just, you know, understood that in a democracy especially, that there is that kind of public vulnerability.
Yeah. You know, Elizabeth, I mean, the comparisons here to how many people view the president and the president himself, the vision that he has, it's kind of a darker vision of America. He does indulge in conspiracy theories. I mean, the comparisons are somewhat unavoidable here. What do you see in that?
Yeah, it was so odd because I was thinking about just yesterday when I was talking with your producer, your wonderful producer, Elizabeth, about, you know, about the topic. And so I started thinking, well, you know, I need to start, you know, scratching back my head and, you know, thinking through all my training in history and just reviewing, you know, McCarthy. And the, you know, the crazy thing is that, you know, the president is certainly much closer to you, to Joseph McCarthy himself and the man he accuses of being like McCarthy. I mean, only in the sense of, you know, if you look at politicians who draw upon our darkest fears, who then, you know, use the media, as McCarthy did, very liberally, so to speak, you know, frequently sending out press releases, you know, with bated breath, and now there's going to be this great revelation, and, you know, sort of all these sort of dark things. And he was also somebody who was a real name caller. Eventually, by the way, it was the Republican Party, his own party, that really stood up to him. Although initially Republicans rode to office on the kind of popular enthusiasm that, or fear, you might say, that McCarthy whipped up. It was really Republicans ultimately who confronted him. But one of them, one of the earliest, was a woman.
Right.
Margaret Chase Smith, Maine, right? And a little tiny Maine, you know, Maine is the plucky sort of state, comes out of, you know, a field you don't expect it, left field, right field, whatever. And she announced what was called a Declaration of Conscience, along with six other Republicans. And McCarthy called her Snow White and the Six Dwarfs.
Elizabeth Cobbs is with us if you've just tuned in. She's a professor of American history at Texas A&M and a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. We asked her to join us this morning because there have been some references, most recently by President Trump himself, about understanding the history of Senator Joseph McCarthy. Now, when the president tweeted this out over the weekend, he was actually talking about special counsel Robert Mueller, saying, beware and study the late Joseph McCarthy. I thought, because there have been some comparisons both ways here in different political conversations, that it would be valuable to actually understand the history of Senator Joseph McCarthy. If you have questions about it, how it applies to today, understanding the history and the legacy of McCarthy, 651-227-6000 on Twitter at @CarrieNPR, where Joe asks, please discuss the character of Roy Cohen. He was a core member of Joseph McCarthy's cadre, and later on, he was a core mentor to Donald Trump. Elizabeth, do you know the history of that?
Yes, certainly. I know some of it. Ray Cohen was one of the team members for Joseph McCarthy, somebody who, you know, was on his team, his prosecutorial team, and was, you know, really a leader. I mean, somebody who supported the whole McCarthyist impetus that, you know, dragged thousands and thousands of people before government committees. They got many thousands of people, you know, fired from jobs, mostly unfairly, for, you know, over a certain period of years. Anyway, Ray Cohen, after that, went back to New York, and where he was from, born in the Bronx, and actually became a legal advisor later in his life to Donald Trump. So actually, if there's any, in a way, lineal descent from McCarthyism to today, it's through Ray Cohen, actually, to the president, ironically.
Yeah. When President Trump used McCarthy's name over the weekend to undermine and disavow special counsel Mueller's investigatory work, I mean, is there a proper historical context? Is President Trump using this reference, do you think, correctly?
No, I don't think he is using it correctly. You know, I think in history we often do this. This is a very common thing that historians know, where we'll say, ah, it's like Vietnam, or, oh my gosh, that's exactly like the Great Depression. And people will throw out terms without actually understanding them and, you know, how those historical events unfolded. So historical comparisons are really meaningful and very helpful to us, I think. I mean, that's, to me, why, you know, I devote my life to writing history, because I think it really gives us such a broader and deeper understanding of our own lives. But it can also be profoundly misleading if you don't know the real history. I was thinking recently about, you know, the way these things happen. Populism whips up people. A really good case, which a lot of people might not be familiar with, but our poor neighbor in South America, Venezuela, you know, which has been just absolutely robbed blind and devastated, this wealthy, beautiful country, by populism and by a political leader who was willing to appeal to people's darkest fears, and who would use historical analogies that, you know, make no sense. In fact, one person said about the only thing you could say about Hugo Chavez is that he had encyclopedic ignorance. So ignorant use of historical metaphors isn't helpful. It's a demagogic way of, I believe, of, you know, throwing around references that don't necessarily apply.
I think what you said earlier about the big lie, the lie so big that people think it couldn't all be wrong. There has to be some kernel of truth. Chavez was really good at that. President Trump uses that. I mean, look at the birther movement. You know, people were drawn in to some of what he said because they thought, could somebody be saying this publicly if there wasn't some kernel of truth to it?
Yes, I mean, I had a student a semester or so ago in Texas who said to me, you know, I just love conspiracy theories.
Really?
And he was wearing a Make America Great hat when he told me that. And, you know, a lovely student, lovely man. And I almost didn't know what to say, because as a historian, you know, we certainly understand, you know, theories about the past that, you know, that can then get proven wrong. And it's odd thing to know why people feel they must hang on to them.
Right.
And it is like this big lie thing, as you're saying, quite right, Terry. People go, oh, well, maybe there's something wrong there. And then it kind of, I don't know, we have an itch we want to scratch for, you know, train wrecks and, you know, things catching on fire or whatever. But the harm there. There is great harm to democracy, to our trust in government. And in a democracy, we must trust in one another. Our government is us. And so granting our institutions trust is really important. And undermining that trust when you don't have to is a very terrible thing, in my opinion.
Call here from Sue in Minneapolis. Hi, Sue.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm enjoying the program. I wanted to say that I was incredibly influenced by the McCarthy-Huack hearings. I was 10 at the time, mm-hmm. and spent my life later in human rights and trying to avoid ever us having another Joseph McCarthy. I watched him harm people, make people cry, make people lose jobs, and be blacklisted, but actually to watch the hearings. Conservatives that I know don't believe in democracy. They don't believe we have it. I think they talk something about a republic, but they don't believe in democracy, and they don't believe in the separation of church and state, and will argue that we don't have that in our Constitution, too. And all of these things make it scary when they've actually gotten somebody elected like Donald Trump, who seems to want to be a dictator and a McCarthy.
I'm going to take the first part of what you said and ask Elizabeth if, as with what happened with Sue, seeing these hearings was really influential to her later work. Do you think politics is in some ways still influenced by that era of Joseph McCarthy?
I think it is, although saying that, I can also tell you that there's a kind of paranoid strain in American history that, you know, that goes back well before McCarthy. I mean, there have been sort of peaks and lulls of that kind of public fear that we have. But I think with McCarthyism, there's really clear connection with, you know, many aspects of political life today. I mean, it was polarizing, and it also created a kind of dialogue in America where, at the time, you know, if you were pink or, you know, if you were a commie sympathizer, that you would just be, you know, tagged and left on the rubbish heap, so to speak. And so that drove foreign policy. Many historians believe that that helped to lead to the Vietnam War, because our presidents, five of them, we had five Vietnam presidents, who all felt kind of boxed in, that if they didn't respond as, you know, as aggressively as the public wanted them to, that they would be called soft on communism. And so that, of course, the Vietnam War helped to create the culture wars, helped to create the kind of polarization we have today. So, you know, the hip bone is connected to the thigh bone sort of thing. But, you know, I think that Sue makes a really great point. You know, when you grow up and you see that, then you know that an important thing to devote your own life to is reasonable conversation, you know, reaching out to people, you know, creating dialogue, calming things down, because the best leaders are like, I don't know, I think the best leaders are like a really good mom or a really good dad. People who go, you know what, here's a problem, but we're going to make it through, and we're going to make it through together.
Elizabeth, always grateful for the time and the insight. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Elizabeth Cobbs is a professor of American history at Texas A&M University, a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, joining us today.